This is Molly Smith introducing our annual Bringing America Back to Life speaker series. At this annual event, we invite those on the front lines of the pro-life and family movement to come together for a convention dedicated to exploring the full spectrum of issues and challenges that confront us as we continue to fight for the sanctity of human life, to protect our God-given family structure. We trust you will be edified and encouraged as you listen to our fine roster of speakers who by their articulate, thoughtful, expert presentations eloquently defend the right to life. And now it is my pleasure to introduce to you Anne Pearson. Anne is the Director of Ministry Services for Loving and Caring, Inc., a national ministry whose mission is to positively affect the physical, spiritual, and moral health of the nation by providing material and services for young men and women who are facing a pregnancy and in need of assistance. The title of Anne's presentation is The Heart and the Soul Joined Together.
I'm delighted to be here with you, and we just finished another workshop, so I'm just a little bit hoarse, but it's good. It means I have a deep voice. This is my first time at this conference, because do you have them every year? That's great. But I do want to say this, that If it wasn't for the Right to Life people, there would be no pro-life. You know, I mean, especially the Catholic. Even when I came in this in 1973, I depended a lot on the Catholic population because I am actually Protestant by religion. But learned very quickly that the Catholics were way out ahead of us. And so was very involved with Birthright and, used them, got a lot of referrals from them. A lot of the girls that lived with us came from them. And so let's just pray before we begin and then we'll be all ready to go. Lord, thank you so much for just allowing us to be together. Lord, it's always a joy because we're always out there individually and as ministries struggling to win this battle for life. And so, Lord, it's such a joy when we can just gather together and enjoy each other and fellowship with each other. So I pray, Lord, that you will do great and mighty things here. And I pray, Lord, that this time together will be a time of just refreshing and almost like a love relationship in the precious name of Jesus. Amen. So I want to start with the scripture. This is one very familiar to you, and it happens to be a favorite of mine. It's John 13, verse 14, and it says, "A new commandment I give to you, love one another. As I have loved you, so you must love one another. By this, all men will know that you are my disciples if you love one another." And I think that sort of says what the pro-life community is all about, that we're about loving those who so desperately need us. And it's a joy to do it. I'm basically going to tell you my story of what's happened in my life. I told some of this at the last workshop, but I'll just quickly go through it. I as a little girl, I was an only child to a mother who had been an orphan and to a father who had been an only child. So the reason I was an only child was because my mother had been malnutritioned. And the pregnancy with me was very hard on her, and she was told that she couldn't have any other children. So I was it. And I lived in a very Catholic neighborhood. I think we were the only Protestants on the street. And my dad was a pastor of a small church. And so all my friends and everything you know, with these big families. So when holidays came, and this was in Washington, D.C., where I was born and all, when holidays came, they had, of course, you know, those of you who are Catholic know how big it is, how big the family gets. And so they had all this company and everything. And for my mom and dad and I, our only relatives were his parents, and they lived in Illinois. So we just were the three of us for those holidays. And that was very hard for me. I was very lonely during those times because I wanted to have that big family, you know, and all of that. But, and I even remember as a little girl wondering what was going to happen to me if my mom and dad died. I thought about that sometimes. So like, where would I go? Would I end up in an orphanage someplace? Well, when I was 13, my parents took in a foster child, and her name was Elizabeth. And she was, I think she was seven. Anyway, as we had her, I was so excited to have a sister. But as we had her, we realized there were some issues with her. So we, my mother had her tested, because my mother was a public health nurse. And so we got her tested, and sure enough, she was mentally challenged. And so that was my first time of meeting somebody mentally challenged, was Elizabeth. But I loved Elizabeth, and I was delighted to have a sister, so it didn't matter to me. Anyway, so she called the foster care people, my mother did, and said, we want to adopt her. That we had found this out and had paid for the testing, which had they had to save to get the testing, and we had the testing, and so she was going to be with us. And, well, they called, the foster care people called right back and said, we're coming for her tomorrow, and she's going to be put in an institution because we put all mentally challenged children in institutions. My parents begged them to not do this and said, you know, we don't want any money or anything. We just want her. And I will never forget that night as I listened to my mother cry all night. Because my own mother's, you know, being in an orphanage, and she, to her dying day, had no idea why she was put in the orphanage, what happened to her life. So she went in very young. We did find out that she had a brother and sister, but they were definitely not in the orphanage with her. And so the next day they came, and I went to school that morning, and when I came home, she was gone. And it broke my heart too, but it broke my heart more of my mother's suffering over it. So time went on, and I met my husband, Jim, who was 4 years older than I was. And okay, I hope you're ready for this. We got married when I was 18. My parents weren't so thrilled about that, but they accepted it, and so we got married and had this little apartment, and life went on, you know. And so we were and decided to be youth leaders in our church, and so we started with the youth, and we started getting kids. Well, now I have to tell you this was during the hippie times. And we also lived very close to Maryland University. So we started getting a lot of kids from Maryland University. So our youth group started growing and growing and growing and growing. And I loved every minute of it. And so one evening, these four girls came to our group from Maryland University. We'd never seen them before. Nobody in the group seemed to know them. But right away, I picked up that one of them was pregnant. So in the process of it all, I found out that the three of them didn't know each other until they got to Maryland University. They were freshmen, excuse me. And they had gone to a freshman party and were given the date rape drug, all three of them. They were all three raped They all three got pregnant. Now, this was in 1972. The only place you could get an abortion was in D.C. So they all made appointments at the abortion clinic. They went to the abortion clinic, and they all got on the tables, lined up, and she got off the table. Melissa got off the table. The rest of them went through the abortion. And so then Melissa called her parents to tell them that she was pregnant and that she wanted to come home. They disowned her, and they cut off all her money to school. And so there she was. Now, she was from the Pittsburgh area. So these girls who had had the abortion, took her into their dorm rooms. And they were taking care of her in there. And they knew they had to find an answer because they were bringing her food from the cafeteria, you know, the whole thing. She hadn't seen a doctor. So they knew they had to do something. So they heard about this youth group, and they decided they would all come together to try to find her something. So after the youth group was over, we just sort of gathered, and I just finally said, you know, we talked about it, and we offered her a place to live. And she came to live with us. Now, living with us was a small little house. I mean, small. We're talking tiny. We had three little bedrooms. And Jim and I were in a bedroom. My two girls, my daughters, were in a bedroom. And my youngest was mentally challenged. And then we had Grandpa, who was 88 years old at the time. And he was in the third bedroom. So obviously there was no room in the inn, so to speak. But we offered it. She immediately accepted. We picked her up the next day with her few belongings and brought her home. And for a while, she slept on the couch. But eventually, we put her on a cot. We put the youngest on the cot in our room, and she shared with my daughter. So anyway, so time went on, and we went to a doctor. I finally found a place you could go and get free medical care. So go to the hospital for that and walk in the room. And it was like a room probably as big as this whole front here. And the whole thing was full of chairs. And it was full of pregnant women sitting in these chairs. And I was shocked. You know, it was like entering into a place you didn't ever even know existed. And there you are sitting there all day, and all of them had packed their lunches. We didn't know you had to pack your lunch to go to the doctor, but they were, you know, because we were going to be there all day because you got a number and you had to wait your turn. So when I saw that, it just like blew me away. And I'm like, why are all these women here, and why aren't people taking care of them? And how is this, you know how it is, you know how it goes, blah, 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 blah. So anyway, So I was shocked, and I started talking to my husband, Jim, about it. And I said, somebody has got to do something about this. This is not good. And so anyway, she came to us and asked us if we would like to have the baby. And we really wanted the baby, but we knew she had nowhere to go, and we felt like we couldn't have the baby and have her there at the same time, you know. So we told her we wouldn't take the baby, but we would help her if she wanted to have the baby with her, that she could still stay with us and all, even though I had no idea where I was going to put a crib. But anyway, so we did that, but she decided on adoption. And this was back in the days where adoptions were very closed. She had no choice in who was picked or anything like that. All she knew was that the child was going into a home. And so it was. So she stayed on with us, and she got a good job, and she started working for the school district, and things were really going well. And so then we got a call from Pennsylvania, because we had been taking our youth to a big prayer and praise service that was going on in Pennsylvania, near Lancaster, Pennsylvania. And so we would go there once a month with all our kids. And I have to tell you this story because I know this is sort of the end of the day for us, and I think this will really inspire you. One night we were at this place. We were in this, you know, had come up to this, and the church, this little church, was packed from the front to the back. People were sitting on the windowsills. People were all sitting in the aisles. I mean, it was just packed. And they had worship and scriptures, and it just was an incredible evening of spending time with the Lord. And the youth loved it. It was just fabulous for them. And so in the middle of this meeting, this doctor gets up, and he comes to the front of the room, and he announces that he had been a doctor in Africa. And he had these two young men who were in a room together, and they were both dying, and he had done everything he knew to do for them. He had just done everything, and nothing had worked. And that night he went to his room and he prayed and he said, "God, I have to tell them tomorrow that they're going to die." Now these men were in their 20s at the time. And God said to him, now I want you to hear this. He said, "You haven't done everything." And he said back to God, "Well, what haven't I done? I've done everything a doctor knows to do." And he said, "You haven't prayed for them. You've done everything you know to do, but you have not laid hands on them and prayed for them." So the next day, now he's telling this in this church. The next day, he goes into their room. He tells them that they've done everything medically that can be done for them. And he lays his hands on them and he prays for them. And they both are instantly healed. And they walk out of the hospital. So he's telling this story about how it changed his life as a doctor. In the very back of this church is this very dark man gets up in the very back of the church and he says to the doctor, "I'm one of those men." Now here we are in a little town in Pennsylvania, and the doctor is a visitor. This guy is obviously a visitor, and they're in this church. And the aisles were so full of people that the guy in the back had to step over people to get till they got to each other, and they met in the middle of the aisle and embraced each other. Well, I'm telling you, that was a life-changing experience for me, because just like Elizabeth was put in my heart to make a difference, this told me God can do anything. And so Jim and I sold everything we owned, which wasn't a lot, and we got in a U-Haul truck, but I went to my grandfather's room, and I said, "Grandpa, we think that God is calling us to go to Pennsylvania and start a home for unwed mothers." And my granddad, laying back in the rocker, 88 years old, and he said, "Are you sure it's God?" And I said, "Yes, I'm sure." And he said, "Pack my bags, I'm going too." And he lived to be 98. He lived in the home. They absolutely adored him. He was, his mind was clear all the way to the end. He burned all our trash. He loved burning trash, except he used his cane to push the trash down, you know? And I kept telling him, "You're burning the end off the cane, Grandpa. Every time you do that, you're going to fall." "Well, that's not a bad way to go, burning trash." And, but it was an amazing situation to have him, for those years in the home with these girls. And they would come in. Now you have to understand, this was the time when we had the little box TVs, you know, the little square things. And we had you remember the first tape machines where you had the little square tape machine and you had a mic. Do any of you remember this? You had a mic and you had to hold it up in front of the person. Okay, well, he was fascinated by the TV, that there such a thing as a TV. So he wanted to tape it. So what he would do is the television would be sitting there and he would take that mic and put it in front of their mouths, you know, like this, the whole show. He was moving this mic back and forth. And the girls kept telling him, you don't have to do that, Grandpa. You can just hold the mic and you'll get it all. No. Got to do this. So anyway, he actually died in the house. And we knew he was dying. And we had a girl live with us who had been moved from place to place. One of her parents lived in California. The other lived in where we lived in Lancaster. And so she lived part-time in this place, part-time in this place. Well, she got pregnant, and both parents just rejected her, and she came to live with us. But in the process of his dying, and I'm telling you this because God uses everything. God uses everything. And so in the process of his dying, she all of a sudden panics and says, I have to leave. I have to leave right now. I can't stay here. Well, why can't you stay here? Because he's dying. Well, you don't have to help with it or anything. And what is the matter here? Well, it turned out that when she was 13 years old, she had been in the house with her grandfather, and he had a heart attack. And instead of getting help, she ran out of the house and left him. And he died. And the entire family blamed her for his death. Now, we are never going to know if he would have died anyway. We just don't know those things. We have no way of knowing that. Now, have you ever been those of you who do counseling, I've been in a room where some issue comes up and there's no way you can know how it's all going to end. You can't possibly know. So we told her, you don't have to come anywhere near the room or anything like that. But we didn't know this story. But when I went up to talk to her, she told me the story. So I can't be near it because I'll make him die. And so we were taking shifts and the girls were sitting with us that wanted to. Anyway, finally it came to the point and we're at the final moment and Jim's just taking over for me. And it's like the middle of the night and here she comes. And she wants to sit with him, wants to sit with Jim in the room with Grandpa. So she pulls up to the bed and she's holding Grandpa's hand. And Jim tells her, if he dies, it's okay because you've been with him to the end. And he died on their watch. So God restored for her where she had made a mistake. God restored for her and gave her another chance. She held his hand because he had to go to the hospital, you know, to be declared dead. Tell the ambulance, Jim had to peel her hand away from his so that he could be taken to the hospital. And she was healed that day of that one issue. And she's become a remarkable young woman. So when we talk about the pro-life community and we talk about it, it's all about individuals. It's one person at a time. And it's an amazing journey. And, you know, we think it's about the baby getting born, but God does so many other things. Much more than we could think or dream. He just is constantly working in our behalf to bring healing and wholeness. And it is amazing. And what time am I supposed to be done? Huh?
Whenever you're ready to be done, you're done.
Oh. Well, wow.
We still have questions.
Okay. Okay. So I wanted to share with you also that as time went on, we had 15 girls at a time in our home. And they all, we sat around a big table, and the one, guess where the best seat in the house was? What would be the best seat? Do do you think? Huh? Next to Jim. But remember this, when they came into our house, they were very afraid of men. And my husband was 6'3", and he weighed 300 pounds. So he was a huge guy. He had been a football player, center. And so they were terrified of him. And so they would stay as far away from him. But the more they learned what a father figure he was, and I'll tell you this, when he asked me to marry him, this was my marriage proposal, okay? We're sitting on the couch watching television. He leans over to me and he says, "Do you think someday we could get married?" Really fast. That was the proposal. Now, he didn't have a ring. He didn't have anything. It was just, doom. And then he said, "And I want to be a father." That was the next sentence. And I'm like, "So are you getting married so you can be a father? What is this?" You know, because he said, no. "I just want you to know that." Well, he certainly got his dream. All girls, of course. We have all girls, and we actually in our family have three generations of all girls. The only way we get a guy is when he marries in. And it's really something. I don't know when it's going to end. But anyway, so all of this has happened, and now we've got all these girls in the house, and we need more room. So eventually we ended up with three homes. Two were maternity homes, and you're going to love this one. The third one was a adoption home. So what that was for was for women who had placed their children, because we found out that when we sent them out into society, the girls who parented, they didn't have a problem adjusting to society, although they didn't always do so well, but they, you know, society accepted them. But for the ones who placed, they would get under pretty bad ridicule and would be hurt and everything like that. So we realized we needed to find a way to keep them together so they could sort of support each other. So we established an adoption home just for women who had placed their children. And when we had that, they had to work or be going to school. That was the rule to live there. And we had five girls at a time in there, and we had house parents. Actually, Jim and I moved into that house to be house parents for them. So that has been my life. Eventually, we left that because we realized that we needed to get homes opened all over the country. The pro-life, the pregnancy centers were opening everywhere, and I had written material for the pro-life community, for the pregnancy centers and stuff like that. So all of that was part of my life. So what I want to say to you all is that we are like a team marching. The political part, the radio part, the help part where we're all helping each other, all that. What is she saying? He's saying questions. Look at that. See that? That's very good. So there is something that I keep with me all the time. I keep it right on, you know where your computer is? I keep it right in front of my computer. And you know what it is? It's Winston Churchill's statement that says, "Never, never, never give up." That's the first thing I keep. I am just absolutely committed to never giving up. Now, eventually I'm going to die. So then when that happens, then I will give up. But I'm going to give you a little special thing at the end because I, do you have the words? One of the things that we're known for in our ministry is that wherever I travel and speak, I take words. Can you just show one of those envelopes for me? And they're in envelopes like this. No two words are the same. And I have a lady who comes into my ministry, and I tell her how many words I mean, and we have like about 800 words in the computers that we've hand-chosen, mostly scriptural words. They're just one word, though. And so she picks the words, so I never know what words are coming. Only she knows. She's a retired teacher, and this is her gift to us. And so we have brought words for all of you, so why don't you pass those around now, if you wouldn't mind, Stacy. And we'll get those handed out. But I would ask that you don't open them until everyone has received them, because we like for you all to open them together, if you could do that for me. I want you to know that, Molly, I'm so grateful that you invited me. We had a great session last session. I actually got to be a girl. I was a client. That was a lot of fun for me. And some of you I know in here and some of you I don't know, but if we can just get all the words handed out, and then you can put them. Now, when you open them, you're going to see they're flat, but they're made so they'll fold. So then you can set them by your computer or your bed, or I keep mine by my bed, and I get one every year. So, and we actually have pregnancy centers who ask us for words, and we mail them to them, like for Christmas or something. They want to give them to everybody. So it's sort of just a special ministry that we have. So I wanted to make sure you all got that from us. Has everybody got a word? Have we got it covered? Okay, why don't you open your word and let's see what you got. We'll just take a minute for that. And then you can just put that anywhere you want and just fold it and have it for yourself, okay? So that's just a gift from us. And we'll open it for questions for you, but I want to state that, you know, I travel a lot, and it's just such a privilege for me to be able to encourage and strengthen. And I still have contact with almost all my girls, except those who have died. I have very active contact with them. And I want to share one story as I finish, and then we'll open it for questions. We were having a banquet. And one of my girls who had lived with us, who was pretty rebellious, after she was 15 when she lived with us, and she had her daughter, and she placed her, and she, most of our girls didn't place, but she placed her child, and she eventually went on to college and has become quite the lady, but she's very adventuresome, and she keeps chickens in her bathtub. Stuff like that, you know, she's just out there, and she lives in the country, and, you know, she's pretty amazing. And so she calls me, and she says, I want to come to the banquet. I said, great, come on, we'd love to have you. Well, she said, I want to bring some guests. I said, okay, who would you like to bring? Well, she says, it's three extra people. I want to bring three extra people. I said, okay, fine. We'll just put you down. So she comes into the banquet room, and you know how it is when you're in charge of a banquet and you're trying to say something to everybody so that, you know, you can greet everybody. Well, anyway, so here she comes, and I see this couple who are definitely older than her, and, you know, they look like parents. And then there's this young woman with her, who's definitely younger than her, and her head is bald, and she's very thin, and she obviously has cancer. And then there's Kathy, my girl. And so Kathy comes up and says, Ann, I want you to meet these people. And she said, I didn't call to tell you what it was, but here it is. And she said, this is my daughter. And she was the one with cancer. And the couple was the adoptive parents. And they'd all come to this banquet. And the daughter steps up to me and puts her arms around me. Now she's dying of cancer. And she's 24 years old. And what happened was that she was in Mexico getting her graduate degree. And she called her mother and told her that she had a lump in her breast. And her mother immediately called the doctor to find out what to do. And the doctor said, well, it can't be cancer because, you know, she's too young. And by the time she got back 3 months later, it had spread and it was terminal. And so this girl puts her arms around me and she hugs me and she whispers in my ear, thank you for saving my life. And she's dying. I will never, ever forget that moment of it's not how long we live, it's how good we live. And then her adoptive parents came up to me and just thanked me so much for the years that they had had with her. And she died shortly after that. And all of us went, you know, including Kathy and all, we all went to the funeral and everything like that. And she had gotten saved. She was, you know, she was a Christian and everything. So when you think about all of this, it isn't always about life. It's also about death. And, you know, these things make a difference as far as eternity is concerned. Amen? Amen. Amen. So let's have questions. Does anybody have a question? Yes.
What do you think that people most need to know about adoption today?
I think that's a great question because I think adoption of international children is very well accepted and people think it's a wonderful thing and people will go to great lengths to adopt internationally and I think it's wonderful too, but they consider adoption here in the United States. For instance, you know, we have over 300,000 children in our foster care system in this country who are eligible for adoption. And because they're not infants, you know, people don't want them. And it's so difficult. And I think that we just need to encourage people to have faith for this and to do it. Because I think when you think about the number of children that we, you know, we're saving children's lives every day. But some of those children are then going into the foster care system because of their parents. And so now we have those children who desperately need to be adopted. And I think that a major thing has to occur here that even as a pro-life movement, we see foster children as a major issue of getting them into homes and out of the system. That would be my answer to that. Is that good? You want more?
I guess looking at it from the birth mother's point of view, I'm not a birth mother, I'm an adoptive mom.
Uh-huh.
My perception is that an awful lot of girls who are giving birth are trying to parent because there is no societal support for the decision to entrust their child to an adoptive couple. And they're sadly unprepared.
Yes.
And then they do end up in the foster system.
Right.
So to me, one of my passions has been, what do we do about changing the culture about the birth mother's decision to recognize it differently and to dispel the, like you were trying to hand your baby over to a faceless bureaucracy that has, you know, no contact or you don't know where they are. Back in the 50s.
Right.
Like that. So how do we change that culture and those perceptions is one of the things.
Well, I think one of the key things is, and we've tried to do this and have had a lot of girls respond to it, is you have to set up a thing where it's always, if you're not able to do this or your life situation changes or whatever, you can always come to us and we will help you find a good home and you can know where the baby is and you can, you know, have contact and those kinds of things so that we're really saying that as we go. So when birth mothers have their babies, they know that, you know, they can have contact. They're not like just losing their children forever, and that allows much more probability that they would choose adoption. But even to set it up, I have had girls call me and say, I can't do this. Will you help me? And have helped them place their children after the fact. In other words, after 3 or 4 months in, they're realizing it was much more than they thought it was. We just had a situation in Louisiana where a young girl had a baby and she was born blind. The baby was born blind. And we're talking a 16-year-old girl has a blind baby. And it's not a real supportive family. So right away, you know, all that was in place to make sure that she knew. And sure enough, she called. But she also needed a place because the family was falling apart. And they were able to find a home that took her and the baby. They adopted them both. So that was just amazing because we saved both of them. Yeah.
And I have one question.
Okay.
I can't read all the writing here, but I think what it's asking is how can adoption be improved to be more effective for parents who are seeking adoption as well as for the children who are being abandoned? How do you improve the adoption system?
Yeah. Did you get it? I think one of the primary issues with adoption is that our society, like I said before, looks really well on international adoptions. They think it's wonderful, but that is not the case. So you almost have to change the heart of the whole country, you know, because without the heart of the country changing on this issue and thinking that adoption is a very viable, powerful response, and it saves lives, you know, and getting that to happen. And that is very hard to do. And it's a matter of prayer. Many of us are praying for this. We're praying that this whole issue will be, that God will just show us a way to take adoption, U.S. adoption, from here up to here. You know, we need some incredible wisdom and new techniques and new things like that that make it that it's, because for adoptive couples, it's wonderful. But for the birth mothers, it's there that we're failing, because they're feeling like failures if they don't parent their children. And many of us who work in this area know that there's many who are not going to do it, and they're not going to do it well. But the thought of their children going into foster care is just agonizing for them. And yet they will still parent, knowing that they themselves are probably going to end up in foster care. So it's not, you know, certainly the public has something to do with this, but a lot of it is the mindset of the women themselves. And because many of them have been abandoned by parents, and they're living with grandparents and all over the place, they understand abandonment. And they don't want to abandon their children, even though they can't take care of them. So what has to happen with every child that's placed, every child that parents, is for them to know clearly, clearly, that if you're not able to do this, we can help you, and we can help you place this child, and we can help you have contact with this child, and it's not going to be the end where, you know, you're never going to see your child again. And a lot of it is just changing the heart of America on this issue. It really, really is. It's like abortion. It's very much like it. Okay? Thank you all so much, and God bless you all and keep you. Thank you, Molly.
You have been listening to a presentation by Ann Pearson, a 2017 Bringing America Back to Life presenter. Ann's title was The Heart and the Soul Joined Together.